I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. At his State of the Union address on Tuesday night, President Obama spoke about cybersecurity threats.
America must also face the rapidly growing threat from cyber attacks. Now, we know hackers steal people's identities and infiltrate private emails. We know foreign countries and companies swipe our corporate secrets. Now our enemies are also seeking the ability to sabotage our power grid, our financial institutions, our air traffic control systems. We cannot look back years from now and wonder why we did nothing in the face of real threats to our security and our economy. And that's why earlier today I signed a new executive order that will strengthen our cyber defenses by increasing information sharing and developing standards to protect our national security, our jobs, and our privacy.
And that order that the president signed allows the government to share information about cyber threats with private companies and to develop strategies to protect computer networks. As the president said, cyber attacks on things like newspapers and banks have increased in recent years, and there are concerns that the power grid, transportation lines, gas and water lines may be vulnerable to cyber attacks. It's our topic for today's Radio Times. We begin with Siobhan Gorman, national security and intelligence correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. And Siobhan, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good to be with you.
So by including this in the State of the Union address, the president was clearly putting the spotlight on this issue. Is he also trying to pressure Congress to do something?
He is. This comment during the State of the Union follows what was a pretty difficult battle on Capitol Hill last year, and it ultimately resulted with the failure of a White House-backed bill to even gain a floor vote in the Senate in August, and so that effectively killed the bill for last year. So he is now putting forth this executive order that will enact somewhat of what the bill was seeking to do in terms of setting standards for voluntary standards for companies running critical infrastructure to meet if they so choose. But he's also using it as a way to push Congress forward and say, you know, we need to enact this into law. There's limits to what we can do from the executive branch.
But we're talking about something that's voluntary.
It is voluntary, but the legislation they were pushing last year would have also been voluntary.
And without getting too much in the weeds, though, help us understand, I guess, what this executive order would do and how the president envisions the government working with private companies.
Sure. It would have the federal government get together with private industry and set standards for what the so-called best practices should be for securing computer systems. So that could be controlling who has access to broad areas of a computer network, trying to limit the number of people who have so-called administrator access, or just having basic rules about how frequently you need to update security software. So setting those types of standards that then companies can choose to voluntarily follow. It would also then have the Department of Homeland Security set up a formal program that companies could join. In addition, it would set up a number of other mechanisms to improve information sharing between the government and the private sector. However, it can't create provisions for the private sector to actually share information with the government because that requires a change in the law.
Oh, interesting. And why did this law not get passed last year by Congress?
Well, it got very tied up in a lot of election year politics, really, and it was over the issue of imposing more government regulations on the private sector, and that's why there were many, many iterations of this bill over a course of 3 years, and the final iteration actually changed the standards and made them voluntary and not mandatory. And these are for companies that run things like the electric grid or nuclear power plants or transportation systems, not everyday companies. But even when it got to that point, a lot of the business groups pushed back very aggressively, saying that even voluntary standards would be a government-controlled system, and they thought that it could ultimately lead to mandatory standards. And they got many powerful Republicans in the Senate, including Senator John McCain, to oppose it, and they ultimately killed the bill.
But, I mean, the election is over, but do you think that has changed?
Sometimes we think that.
Exactly. But do you think that changes anything or would change someone's mind on this issue?
I don't know that it's going to change anyone's mind on the issue, but it could make people a little bit more willing to compromise. I mean, I haven't gotten the sense that even folks on the administration side really are putting high hopes in the likelihood of getting legislation passed this year. But, you know, we heard some positive signs from the top Democrat and Republican on the House side yesterday saying that they thought they could find a compromise with the White House. However, when they outlined what that compromise would look like, it looks a lot more like the White House suddenly agreeing with them rather than the other way around. So there are still a lot of differences about whether or not there should be a congressional law to establish this system of voluntary standards for critical infrastructure companies.
Were there privacy concerns, though?
There are some privacy concerns when it comes to some of these data sharing provisions, but those tend to be pretty technical. And I think that most of the folks involved in crafting the legislation think that there are probably ways to address the privacy concerns. And I don't, while that's one stumbling block, the major one is really this question of whether or not a voluntary program still amounts to regulation.
I'm looking at an article that you wrote back in January. Banks seek U.S. help in Iran cyber attacks. Major U.S. banks are pressing for government action to block or squelch what Washington officials say is an intensifying Iranian campaign of cyber attacks against American financial institutions. And one of the things that you say in this article is the fact that these banks are looking to the government seems to indicate that they're worried about these cyber attacks.
Well, they're certainly worried about it. But what was also interesting was that the financial services companies broadly opposed the cybersecurity legislation last year to set the minimum standards. And when you talk with bank officials, they say, well, what they want for these Iranian cyber attacks is the government to really help with the blocking and tackling of the actual attack. And they still don't necessarily want standards imposed on them because banks say that their standards are already very high. And the real work that the government should be doing is countering, you know, state-based threats and taking down the attack mechanisms for these cyber attacks. But, you know, some administration officials see some irony in that position.
Does the government have a capability at this point to block these attacks on these banks?
Apparently this particular set of attacks has a number of complexities, but, you know, a lot of folks at the banks maintain that the government, if it really set its mind to it and worked with the internet service providers, could do a lot to mitigate the attacks. If not completely stop them, they could certainly block their effects significantly.
Well, let me talk about some of the apparently Chinese hackers infiltrating both the Wall Street Journal and also the New York Times computer system. What do we know about that?
The Wall Street Journal has sustained a series of cyber attacks. I think the most recent infiltration occurred roughly midway through last year, and that seemed to be targeting folks in our Beijing bureau. And one of the reporters who was targeted, Jeremy Page, had been writing a lot about the scandal of Bo Xilai, who was a Chinese leader who is now no longer a Chinese leader because he got tied up in a whole series of a murder scandal, really. I think, at least speaking from the journal standpoint, I think that was the most recent in what has been a series of cyber infiltrations. And I think that our security folks, at least from my reporting, because we don't actually get a lot of cooperation from our company in reporting these things.
Oh, is that right?
But my reporting suggests that, they're still very vigilant, but I have a feeling, I think that they're expecting that these folks are going to keep trying to come back and, you know, may well succeed. And the, you know, success from the Wall Street Journal standpoint will be that we kick them out again quickly.
Interesting. But are we talking about cyber spying? Are we talking about destroying data, finding out contacts from journalists from the Wall Street Journal based in China?
I think that in this circumstance, the main concern was finding out contacts, especially for reporters who are based in China. However, the folks who got into the Wall Street Journal system didn't just look at stuff from China, it sounds like, from speaking with my sources here, which I realize sounds strange, they didn't just focus on China. They also focused on other things, although we weren't able to learn what those other things were. I did speak with people who were concerned that in the future folks might try to get into the Wall Street Journal's information, the financial information, not about the company, but about the rest of the world, in which case, you know, if they know that somebody's working on a story about a merger and acquisition, that can help them, benefit in the stock market or seek to change information that might manipulate markets. So none of that happened, but I know that there is a concern that that could be where it's going, especially if you try to go after a newspaper like the Wall Street Journal.
Well, I mean, it sounds like there's just a lot of secrecy associated with this whole issue of cyber attacks and how to defend against cyber attacks.
Yes. Well, a lot of organizations don't want to talk about how they're defending against it because they don't want to give a roadmap to the attackers for how to get around it.
And would it be fair to say that cyber, is attack too strong a word, or cyber spying, cyber threats, that has increased over the recent years?
Well, probably all of those things have increased over the recent years. I think that one of the things that specialists in this area try to draw a distinction, I think this is probably the right thing, between an infiltration where you are in somebody else's system and you're basically stealing information to try to benefit you in some way or another, as opposed to an attack that is trying to disrupt somebody's operations. So the attacks on banks are definitely attacks. They're not the most sophisticated, but they're more sophisticated than average, and they are aimed at disrupting operations. The kinds of attacks that were that the same Iranian group allegedly mounted against a Saudi oil company actually went in and destroyed data, and that has been incredibly alarming to folks on the U.S. side, particularly in the banking industry, because they feel like basically what they've seen with the first spate of attacks really just is phase one of something that could become much more sophisticated, could ultimately find their way inside bank systems and actually manipulate or destroy data, which would have, pretty significant economic consequences.
Well, indeed. I mean, that sounds worrisome, frankly.
It is worrisome. That is worrisome.
And if politics is sort of preventing the U.S. at least to address this issue, do you think just some of these stories will move people in a more compromising position, if I can use that word?
It's possible, though, when you talk with people, even advocates of the legislation that would enact a set of voluntary standards, or even advocates of mandatory standards, they will say that is not a panacea. That is not going to prevent the Iranian cyber attacks, right? Because what prevents the Iranian cyber attacks is the U.S. government either going after the individuals that they know are perpetrating this, or doing something vis-a-vis Iran in more of a foreign policy circumstance, as well as from a technical standpoint, trying to kind of take down the attack mechanism. So, there are multiple things that would need to be done to deal with this. And one of the issues that we've alluded to but not really talked about very much is just the rampant spying and theft of intellectual property against companies, which is, a big problem, too, that they have not gotten their arms around.
Well, Siobhan Gorman, thank you very much for getting us started today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. National security and intelligence correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. We are talking about cyber threats, and we have two guests waiting in the wings, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Are you or is someone you know overweight? Drexel University is currently enrolling overweight participants in Mind Your Health, a research study evaluating methods of losing weight and keeping it off without medication. These programs are funded by the National Institutes of Health. More information online at drexel.edu/weightloss or 215-762-4900. That's 215-762-4900. Drexel supports WHYY.
I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. If you're wondering what to get me for my birthday today, how about making a pledge of support to WHYY and becoming a member? That would make me very happy. Call 1-888-345-9499 or pledge online at WHYY.org. Now, if my birthday isn't enough enticement, how about a pledge to celebrate Terry Gross and Dave Davies, who also have birthdays today? 1-888-345-9499, WHYY.org. Thanks very much.
Inishnua Theater Company supports WHYY, dedicated to staging contemporary plays from Ireland, England, Scotland, and Wales. Inishnua is currently presenting Scottish playwright D.C. Jackson's My Romantic History, directed by Tom Ring, now through February 24th at the Off Broad Street Theater, 1636 Sansom Street. More information is online at tellthestory.us. tellthestory.us.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscone. On Tuesday night, President Obama said in his State of the Union address that the U.S. needs to address the growing threat of cyber attacks. He this week signed an executive order directing government agencies to share information about cybersecurity threats with the private sector. We just said goodbye to Siobhan Gorman from the Wall Street Journal. Let me introduce our two new guests. Alan Poller is a security expert, founder, and director of research for SANS, and that's a cybersecurity training school. Alan Poller, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good to be here.
Also with us is James Lewis. He's a senior fellow director of the Technology and Public Policy Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And James Lewis, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Hi, Marty.
James Lewis, let me begin with you. Is the U.S. under siege from cyber threats, cyber attacks?
Yeah, that's a little traumatic, don't you think? I mean,
I don't know.
It's more... Well, I'll say no.
That's why I'm asking. Now, go ahead.
Good. The siege is the wrong word, but incredibly vulnerable is a better word, both in terms of the ability of foreign governments to gather espionage here and from the risk that either those governments or governments like Iran or maybe some political group will do some kind of hacking that will really disrupt a critical service. So we are really vulnerable. That's probably the way I think of it.
Do you see it that way, Alan Poller?
Jim's got it right on the vulnerability. There is a wave of attacks that Siobhan was talking about that has accelerated in the last couple of years. So siege is probably not the right word, but every day, every newspaper, every large country, most of the law firms, many organizations that do business abroad are being penetrated or attempts are being made to penetrate. So I might go along with siege.
You might go along with siege because you're saying it's so common, it's happening every day?
It's happening every day, and in the last 8 or 9 months, it's accelerated a great deal. So the number of siege is as much an inability to deal with it as it is the number of attacks, and the numbers have gotten so great that the number of people in the country who can respond to it are terribly insufficient to find what Siobhan was talking about, discover them when they get in and get them out fast. We don't have the people to do that in the United States.
And I do want to pick up on that. Jim Lewis, let me go back to you. I think it's important to define what it is we're talking about, if we're talking about cyber threats. And just so that we and our listeners are all on the same page, how do you define it?
Three categories. First, there's cyber crime, which is criminals using the internet to extract money, largely, from American financial institutions. This isn't the spam you get from Nigerian princes offering to cut you in. This is more going directly after the big banks and taking money out of them. Cyber espionage, particularly industrial espionage, where companies lose intellectual property, and Siobhan talked about this, lose commercial data, data on upcoming deals, on mergers and acquisitions. Very extensive. Now, how much of a risk it is, we can have a debate about, but it's generally a bad idea to just sit back and watch it. And then the third category is cyber attack, which is the one that usually gets the most hyperventilation. There really haven't been any cyber attacks against the U.S. I mean, if you define attack as the disruption or the destruction of services. But the risk that there could be such an attack is growing. And the biggest risk for me is in the fall of last year, we saw the Iranians do two things at the same time. Or it's widely alleged to be the Iranians. And, we can just say it's the Iranians. They destroyed data on 30,000 computers in a Saudi company, Saudi Aramco, Arab-American oil company. And they launched denial-of-service attacks against major U.S. banks, basically disrupting their websites simultaneously. And I think that was a test. They were testing an attack tool. They were testing how the U.S. would react. So however nervous you were before, you should be a little more nervous because now the Iranians are playing in the ballgame.
Well, and Jim, when you say the Iranians, are we talking about the Iranian government? Are we who are we talking about? I realize you're saying we might not know them by name, but what do you mean by that?
I mean the Iranian Revolutionary Guard and the Basiji, which is a paramilitary group that operates at the behest of the Iranian government. And they've set up something called the Iranian Cyber Army. And, you know, like any good intelligence operations, they create fake flag groups and give them false names like Sons of the Avengers or Avengers of the Sons or something. And it's the Iranian government.
Alan Pollard, let me go back to you. And I'm interested. Your concern is that we do not have enough people trained in this country to either, I guess, fend off some of these attacks or to prevent them. Why don't we have those people?
Partly because the problem is new, partly because the problem is very hard, but mostly because there are no teachers of it. In order to do this, is like flying a jet fighter. If you have no jet fighter pilots, it's really hard to find somebody at a college to teach you how to fly a jet plane. And the challenges that the attacks have come so rapidly in so many different places, and people are trying to respond to them in so many different ways that there simply isn't a national program to find the talented people and get them into the right educational programs. There's a new attempt like that called Cyber Centers that Governor Christie is doing in New Jersey, and may be the model for the country. But other than that, there really isn't any program in the United States that's building cyber talent.
So the attackers have more talented hackers than any security organization?
I don't have data about all the countries, right. But in China, every PLA district every spring grabs all the hackers they can find and put them in a competition, and the ones that do best go into a 30-day, 16-hour-a-day computer network exploit training program and then compete regionally. And the winner in Chengdu District in 2005, a guy named Tan Weilin, was found inside the Pentagon by December and found many of the most useful vulnerabilities in 2006. So they've got a massive national program to find and train and develop hacking talent that can be useful in military situations.
Would that work in this country, do you think, that same idea?
I don't think if the military did it, it would be quite as effective. But I think using competitions to find people, that's Jim Lewis was very helpful in something called the U.S. Cyber Challenge, which is designed to do exactly that. And this new Cyber Centers program is based around competitions for returning veterans and for students who have talent. I think it'll work. But as I said, Governor Christie is trying it. We'll know shortly how well it works.
Jim, you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, I think that it's a new field, and so people are getting into it. One of the things we did this study, that's what Alan's referring to, that led to some work. You know, what you learn in school can be very theoretical, and often what you need is actual practical knowledge. So it'll take a while for universities or maybe other kinds of schools to learn to start teaching more useful stuff.
But would it be fair to say, and I'll put this to you, Jim Lewis, that if we are vulnerable, to use your word, we're vulnerable when it comes to things like the power grid or perhaps even our transportation systems or, as I mentioned in my intro, gas and water pipelines, perhaps even nuclear power plants? Is that where we're vulnerable?
Yeah, it's anything that runs on a computer network is a target for attack. And so the question would be if the computers controlling the system were taken out of service or if they were given commands to disrupt in some way, what would happen? So it varies from infrastructure to infrastructure, but the electrical grid is a good target, oil and gas pipelines. Things that are big and networked are really interesting targets because you could have you could do a lot of things quickly.
You use an interesting word, interesting. What do you mean by that? No, that's okay.
Yeah.
That's
okay. No, it's if you were an outside planner and you were looking to say, you know, I want to get the Americans' attention, what can I do? You might not go after water facilities, for example, because there's a lot of them. It's hard to, you know, there's still a lot of physical activity needed you know, someone has to turn a switch somewhere. But when you look at the electrical grid, and some of your readers, some of your listeners might very well have experienced the 2003 blackout. Well, that shows how, you know, a little bit of network disruption. It was not a cyber attack, but you could replicate the 2003 blackout with a cyber attack. And that could be a useful thing to do for some countries in some situations.
And that's Jim Lewis. He's a senior fellow director of the Technology and Public Policy Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Alan Powler with us as well, a cybersecurity expert, also the founder and director of research for SANS, S-A-N-S, and that's a cybersecurity training school. Our topic for today's Radio Times, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I do want to get to our callers, but Alan, let me ask you about your response to President Obama's executive order this week. Do you think this at least makes some progress addressing what we've been talking about?
I think it makes some progress. It is not enough. We'll know it's not enough when some of the things Jim is talking about start to happen, and we said, "Ooh, who is in charge here?" When we should have been acting instead of admiring the problem. So yes, there's something there. I think what the key to that plan is that it calls for action now. Well, it calls for prioritized action lists now, and that we actually know what to do. A year and a half ago, 2 years ago, we didn't know what to do to stop most of these Chinese attacks. We now know what to do. We're just not doing it. And if the executive order catalyzes the shift from studying the problem to acting on the problem, then it will have had a great effect, even without regulation.
What do you think about it, Jim? And then we'll get to Joe, who's calling us.
No, I'm really pleased that the executive order has come out. One of the things that probably won't surprise anyone is it's hard to get stuff done in Washington. I know that's a newsflash.
It is a newsflash, yes.
Yeah. And so that they were able to make this much progress, I mean, within the realm of what's politically possible, it's actually a good step. And it will do some good things. It will help us think about standards. It will help industries think about what they need to do to secure their networks. Boy, we're in such bad shape, anything would be an improvement.
Well, it's interesting. Let me get Joe from, looks like, Douglasville to join our conversation. And, Joe, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
I have a comment to make, and I'd like to hear your guest's answer to it.
Me too.
During the TARP crisis, when they were distributing the money to the banks, there was $400 million going here and $200 million going there. And I realized from reading about it that we don't actually have paper money anymore. The money is really just a number in the computer of the bank. And there's rarely even checks that are passed around anymore between big businesses. Most of what we're calling money is a number. And I'd like to hear your guest comment on what the vulnerability of that is and what the long, what the big implications of a cyber attack on a major bank knocking out those numbers that represent the money. My other comment would be about a cyber attack on a national election, since we have computerized elections now.
Well, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Alan Pollard, can I give you Joe's first question about banks and electronic money?
That particular risk is one that has been known to keep CEOs of major Wall Street firms up at night. In fact, that was the comment Hank Paulson said to the president. That's what keeps me up at night when the president asked him the same question. So, yeah, that's real.
That's real. Is that real, Jim, from your perspective?
Sure. The banks have made a real effort, and so we don't know whether or not that kind of big disruption is possible. I mean, the key to, there's something called Fedwire, which is exactly what your caller was talking about. Nobody writes checks anymore. All the money is electronic. Banking is really an IT industry, and because that's where loads of money is, everyone's trying to break in. What we don't know is the banks are doing a pretty good job, but it's not 100% successful. In fact, we know the banks have been hacked. And, you know, we don't want to wake up someday and find out how successful some opponent has been.
But do you think banks and others that have been hacked are reluctant to admit it for fear of being, I guess, targeted again because they appear to be vulnerable, but also the kind of embarrassment that they were hacked, Jim?
It's entirely embarrassment. I mean, you're not telling the bad guys anything they don't already know. So I don't That one's just something people made up as an excuse. Mm. Let me give you an example. Siobhan was involved in this, actually. It was one of her stories. A big bank allegedly was hacked and had, some number of millions of dollars extracted. They denied it publicly. I heard from highly placed sources in a position to know in the U.S. government that the incident had occurred, right? But the bank continued to deny it. And at the end of the day, I think they just classified it as an operating cost. You know, we didn't, it wasn't actually a loss because it's just part of our normal operation. So you can't blame them. I mean, you know, if a bank went out and said, hey, by the way, our systems are vulnerable, they might lose a lot of customers. And frankly, the banks are probably one of our safer sectors when it comes to this kind of stuff.
I'm curious about, Alan, and with the work that you do and trying to get banks or other organizations or institutions that have been hacked to, I guess, admit it and then take steps to do something about it.
Well, they do admit it, but they don't admit it publicly. So what happens immediately after one of these attacks is that they bring in people who can clean up the messes. And in fact, our entire knowledge source about how the attacks actually work come because many of our faculty members are the people they bring in afterwards to clean up the messes. They just don't admit it publicly for all the reasons that Jim mentioned.
But I guess that if what the government, it seems like what President Obama was talking about is we need more information sharing. I sense a reluctance, Alan, that some of these organizations or institutions want to share that information.
Right. They will not share it. They will do just what Jim's talking about. In fact, those people who handle the attacks afterwards are probably the right source to do the information sharing. In the health world, we have the Center for Disease Control.
Right.
You don't ask the patient to tell that he has a bad disease, but you do ask the doctors to report on frequency. And in this field, the people who come in after the attacks to find out what happened, they're called forensics experts.
Right.
They come in afterwards, they find out what happened, and then they clean up the mess and they get people back and operating. Those are the people who actually know how the attacks can be stopped and what the actual threat is. And having them share the knowledge on behalf of their customers, but keeping the customers anonymous, is a really comfortable way to solve this problem. That came up in Jim's commission on cybersecurity for the 44th presidency, but no one ever picked up on it.
Oh, well, you just did, Alan. Jim, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, I think Alan agrees that information sharing is kind of a second-level measure. I think he agrees anyhow. Because
sure.
we don't know about at least a quarter of the attacks are totally new and unknown to us, so there's no mm-hmm. information to share. Unfortunately, those tend to be the best ones. You know, there's other things you can do that will work better. Information sharing also assumes that if you tell somebody, they're going to take some kind of action. That's like mm-hmm. telling people don't smoke because it's bad for you. Maybe over 20 years we'll see the rate go down. Maybe we won't. So I'm not a big fan of information sharing. I think it's okay, but it's definitely not enough.
Well, there is another dimension on the information sharing.
Well, you know
problem.
What, Alan, hold on to that thought only because we're up on a break here, and we have to take a very short break. Then we'll get back to our conversation. We're talking about I don't want to be overly nervous about this, but we're talking about the threat of cyber attacks. This week, the president signed an executive order to protect the country's critical infrastructure from cyber attacks. It's an issue he brought up in his State of the Union address. We're talking with James Lewis from the Center for Strategic and International Studies and Alan Pollard, a cybersecurity expert. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Penn Medicine supports WHYY. Doctors at Penn's Depression Research Unit have been studying the causes and treatment of mood disorders since 1964 and are currently performing research to develop improved treatments. Symptoms may include mood swings, low energy, and low motivation. Initial evaluations are offered to determine those who are eligible for treatment. More about Penn's Depression Research Unit at 215-662-3462. 215-662-3462.
I'm Marty Moscowane. We have a big job today, you and me. We need to raise enough money to end the winter membership campaign by the end of the day. If you haven't made a pledge of support, do it right now. Call 1-888-345-9499 or pledge online at WHYY.org. Since it's Terry Gross's birthday today and Dave Davies' birthday today and my birthday today, why not give us all a big Valentine and make a pledge of support? 1-888-345-9499. Thanks so much for that pledge.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. This Valentine's weekend, the Philadelphia Orchestra, under Rafael Frubeck de Burgos, performs Carl Orff's Carmina Burana live in concert. Tickets are available online at philorch.org or by phone 215-893-1999. February 14th, 15th, and 16th, Valentine's weekend at the Kimmel Center, Carmina Burana with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. Cyber attacks on newspapers and banks have increased in recent years. There are concerns that power grids or transportation lines, gas, water lines may be vulnerable to cyber attacks. And we're talking about all of this with Alan Poller. He's a cybersecurity expert, the founder, director of research for SANS, a cybersecurity training school. Also with us is James Lewis. He's a senior fellow, director of the Technology and Public Policy Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Any questions or comments, do give us a call. Alan, do you want to weigh in with what you wanted to say right before the break?
I just wanted to add an item to Jim's information sharing. Even if you have the data, you need the skilled people to put it to work. And what that brings up is that most of the problem that we're dealing with is not caused by the banks. It's not caused by the newspapers. It's actually enabled by the technology that we buy. When SANS runs something called the Internet Storm Center, which is the early warning system for the Internet, we publish how many minutes it takes for an average computer that you bought from Best Buy to get hacked. And it's in the 21-minute kind of range, not even long enough to put new patches on it in many cases. And that's because the systems are sold in a terribly vulnerable way. Jim was talking about the value of the executive order of setting standards. It's not standards that users will have to do. It's better ways of buying technology so that the suppliers can give us safer technology the first time rather than selling us unsafe technology and making all of us try to secure it. So that's where the hope is. We can't share our way out of this. We have to defend our way out of it, and the only way we can defend it is by getting the vendors to sell safer systems and maintain them more safely.
Here's a silly question, but why don't we have better system, better technology? What's the holdup, I guess?
Jim, you want to do that?
Yeah, do you want to do that, Jim?
Oh, I was hoping you'd do it, but I'll say, you know, one time I gave a talk where I said that the Internet was kind of like the Model T. You know, it had wooden wheels and no safety glass and no locks on the door. And people said that was wrong. It was an outrage that I said it was like the Model T. It's actually more like the Model A. So it's just, this is primitive stuff. I mean, it hasn't been around that long, and people didn't worry about security. And when computing started, it was all standalone stuff. I remember the first computer I worked with was, you know, a room-sized, and it was inside an air-conditioned glass room and surrounded by people with white coats. And we're still kind of, you know, unfortunately working off that model. And then they layered on top of that this Internet thing that, well, we'll connect all these universities, and we're all universities. We trust each other. We know each other. So we don't have to worry about security. We don't have to worry about identity. And that's what we've heard, and it's just going to take us apparently many years to dig ourselves out of this hole.
I'm looking at something that was in National Journal recently. Just quoting here, it says the 2013 National Intelligence Estimate identifies by name France, Israel, and Russia as nations that have engaged in hacking for economic purposes. Jim Lewis, should we be surprised that some of our allies have been, or people that work in allied countries have been either hacking or spying on U.S. businesses?
No, it's, you know, I thought the report actually identified the leading culprit as China, and protecting intellectual property in China has a long history of trouble. Right. The Russians have been. The Russians are actually the first cyber espionage incident we know about. In the early 1980s, they broke into university research and DoD research computers. God knows how they did it back then, because this was before the internet. But they hired hackers in West Germany to break into U.S. computers to steal military technology. This has been going on for a long time, and some of these people are really good at it.
Let me get, looks like Dave from Westchester to join our conversation. And Dave, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, hi. Thanks. I am associated with an organization, a nonprofit, that recently got raided to the tune of several hundred thousand dollars.
Oh,
and,
wow.
And there was a happy ending in that the banks were able to, you know, kind of step up and help out. But it was amazing how quickly the money got dispersed. And I'm just kind of wondering, as an individual, are there things that we can be doing to protect ourselves? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Well, Dave, I'm really sorry to hear that happen. Let me give Alan Paller a chance to respond. What do you think, Alan?
There is something you can do. That is a terrible attack, because it's going against churches, it's going against nonprofits. They're losing everything, and many of the banks are not paying, not covering their costs. Only a few banks are actually covering the costs, so many of these people are small businesses are losing money. And all of these, for the most part, happen exactly the same way. A person who does online banking also does other things on the internet. So we might go visit a website. And what most people don't know is many of the what are called safe websites are actually distributing malware, because they've been hacked. They don't know they've been hacked. So they can infect your computer, even like the American Enterprise Institute was doing that for a long time when people were visiting it. These are trusted places that infect you. And because you can't know your computer's infected, the only known effective solution for small businesses and home computer users and for churches and nonprofits is to have a separate computer that does the banking.
Really?
It doesn't cost anymore. Just a computer you do nothing else with but your banking. You never go to a website. You never do email. You do nothing but banking. That's the one place that you make it hard. It's not impossible to use to do it to you, but that's the simplest, least expensive, couple hundred dollars for another machine, and you really have a nice defense. And that's for home users who do online banking or online stock work, and for businesses.
Oh, that's interesting. Jim, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, and the one thing to think about is passwords are really easy to crack. I know we all use passwords, and they're very easy to break. And so you can complicate things a little bit by, you know, not using your dog's name as a password. And I'm not saying that you did this, but moving to a complicated password, we've all heard it. But if you don't do that, it's literally seconds to figure out how to get your password once people are looking.
And do you suggest people keep changing their passwords just to stay ahead of the hackers?
Yeah, I mean, it depends. Again, this is always a question of how much risk you like and how much effort you want to put into it. But if you are worried about it, yes, change your password frequently, use a standalone computer, do all the things Alan said.
Dave, thanks for the call. Let's see what Trish from Bluebell has to say. And Trish, go ahead. You are on Radio Times.
Yes, as a consumer, I'm concerned about paperless transactions. They want you to do, if, for example, your mortgage company or your banking wants you to do everything electronically. And we all do on our computers, on our phones, whatever device we use. So my concern is the paperless. Where's your paper trail as a consumer? What's the risk of doing everything on your computer, everything on your phone? And I'll hang up and listen to your response.
Trish, thanks.
Thank you.
You're welcome, Trish. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. I'm going to toss that back to you, Alan, and I'd like to hear from you as well, Jim.
The risk is there. It's very small. And the cost savings to the companies and the convenience to you tends to be so great that paper trails are a thing generally of the past.
You think so, Jim?
Well, I'm probably a stick in the mud, because I still, like, you have to have some backup. So I still do paper, right? Because I've had my so many, it just, knowing the risks, I like to have some kind of backup. So you need to have some way to have a backup and not just depend on the charity of strangers to know what's in your account.
picking up on something you had said earlier, Alan, and thinking just how sophisticated so many, I'm thinking young people, but so many people are when it comes to computers and technology, and even, you know, hackers that can be, you know, turned into solid citizens. Isn't that a good source of people you could train to protect from cybersecurity attacks?
Yes, a very large percentage of students have broken into other people's computers and attempted to. We had a class at Magnet High School all the technical students at a Magnet High School in Washington area. We asked how many of them had computer at home, and then we said, stay standing if you've actually broken into a computer that didn't belong to you. And 30% of the students were standing. The poor teachers are saying, not you too, Jenny. So it's a very common thing. They do know a lot, and that's why we think competitions, real-world competitions, will bring some of them, keep some of them from using that in ways that make them into felons, and allow them to use some of that talent to help the nation run an economic system it can trust and protect the military as well.
And were these students just kind of goofing around, or did they have criminal intent?
Cyber is the video games of this decade. So they were challenging themselves, they were exploring, they were seeing how far they could get, they were, you know, seeing how high their score was, they were doing it for bragging rights, all the reasons you do things that are activities in high school.
And that's Alan Paller. He's a cybersecurity expert. Also with us, Jim Lewis, and he is a director of the Technology and Public Policy Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Any questions or comments you might have, give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. I'm Marty Moscowane, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Jim, let me ask you about Stuxnet and the U.S. involvement with Stuxnet, apparently infiltrating Iranian and nuclear facilities. What should we know about Stuxnet? And it's clear that the U.S. has been doing its own cyber spying using this new technology.
Well, it shouldn't be a big surprise to anyone that big countries, including the U.S., use the new technology for espionage and military purposes, right? The U.S. tends to be a little more open about it than other places. They still haven't admitted to Stuxnet, and, you know, there's might have been some Israeli involvement, but everyone assumes it was us. This is just another tool for people to do things that states have always done. You know, we fly drones over Iran, and we probably do other things in Iran, and the Iranians have a nuclear program that is probably illegal and definitely not in anyone's interest. So this is just a new way to play a very old game.
Do you want to add to that, Alan?
No, but I think that we should, not to that one directly, but I think we ought to just look for a moment at the military dimension of this, because the Stuxnet was a military operation, whoever did it. At a speech at CSIS, the admiral who ran the cyber fleet for the Navy said something very interesting. He said, the United States dominates in kinetic weapons, that's missiles and planes and bombs, but the other side is spending much of its money investing in taking command and control of our kinetic weapons so that we don't even know where they're going and we don't have control over them. And he finished by saying, we're on the wrong side of the power curve by a factor of four. And he was in a position to know. Mm-hmm. If you remember the Israeli strike on Syria, the Syrian radars showed no planes coming in because they had been hacked. So there was no military response to the planes because they didn't know they were there. That's the future of warfare. Cyber warfare is a part of the It's not something in lieu of regular warfare. It's part of regular warfare. And having the people who can do that well, and more importantly, having the people who can defend the economic systems and the personal systems and the military systems is a great challenge for the U.S., and it's something we have to take on now.
Let me see what Bev from Cherry Hill has to say. And, Bev, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, thank you, Marty.
You're welcome.
My question is, what is the possibilities that hackers could take control of our drones and direct them back at us?
Jim, do you want to take that?
Sure, probably zero. Not to say they haven't tried, right? The Iranians claim to have been able to hack into the drone that they captured, but their story is about as credible as them saying they caught it with butterfly nets. And I'm being a little dismissive of them because they just tend to make stuff up. The command and control is encrypted. What you might want to look for, and this would be interesting, mm-hmm. The command and control, the ground station to the drone, encrypted, hard to do, difficult. But the and this gets to Alan's point about using separate computers. The people sitting in Nevada or wherever they're doing it, they have computers on their desk. They use those computers to control the drones. And the question is, are they, you know, also using those computers to do things on the internet? And that could be something you hadn't thought of. A good technique is to, you know, people go to work and they bring their, you know, iPad or their iPhone, and they get to work and they want to charge it, so they plug it in, right? So you could have a secure network controlling the drones where people are charging their iPhones, and that'll give a sophisticated opponent like mm-hmm. China or Russia a chance to get in. It's something we have to look at. Right now, probably not going to happen, but it's something we need to pay attention to.
Thanks for the call, Bev, to Radio Times. And Alan, you seem to at least you were you're more comfortable with the word, I guess, cyber attack or even cyber warfare. Do you think? And we're almost up on at the end of the show here, but do you think it's going to take some kind of actual cyber attack to get the kind of response that you're looking for?
Every time a company gets hacked, suddenly things get fixed, and it doesn't seem to spread. So, meaning if my friend got hacked, right. I don't fix it. So right. The answer to your question is yes, I think it'll take something really terrible before we actually do the right thing.
Like a power grid, I mean, attack on a power grid, something like that?
Yeah, an outage that costs a lot of lives.
A lot of lives?
Yeah. And a power grid, a long power outage will cause a lot of lives to be lost.
Well, I hate to end on that note, but the clock tells me we have to end the hour. Alan Paller, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times. Thank you, Alan.
You're welcome.
And, we're done, man. Thank you very much for joining. Sorry about that. For joining us today on the show, Director of Research for SANS, that's a cybersecurity training school. Jim Lewis, thank you for joining us as well.
Thanks a lot.
You're welcome. He's a senior fellow, director of the Technology and Public Policy Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program, including Facebook, Twitter, podcasts, email, the archives. I'm Marty Moscone. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back.